The secret recipe. I guess we're all trying to find that, aren't we? But you know, you gotta boil it down to the components, aren't they? A fad, basically. Okay. It's another thing for social media influencers to push to try and all this sort of nonsense. One sentence answer is only train when you can gain. Is solid food at the bottom of the stage, mm-hmm. and then liquid and gel food at the top of the hill. We want those muscles and your system basically packed with carbs,
yeah,
which is going to be the primary fuel for most group rides. And this is something that you'll see if you sneak around the back of the pits at a World Cup. Is you're going to see.
Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we're going to be taking you deeper than ever into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. Seven Mesh are back supporting the podcast, and they've got a very generous offer for you, Downtime listeners. I'm a longtime fan of Seven Mesh, and through wearing their kit, I've experienced their unwavering commitment to crafting top-quality, innovative mountain bike clothing. In the past, I've raved about the versatility of their Chilco Anorak, but this winter, I've been super impressed by their new Grip Pants, which feature their in-house developed AirMap material technology. I can tell you that the Grip Pants are a game changer. Their water resistance easily withstands showers and shields you from trail spray during rides. Yet, the air permeable sections ensure they breathe far better than any waterproof pants I've ever worn, eliminating that unpleasant boil in the bag sensation. As a result, the Grip Pants have become my trusted companion for the majority of rides this winter and spring. And with spring finally arriving, it's the perfect time to refresh your riding gear. Seven Mesh have just unveiled their mountain bike collection for spring-summer 2024 over on sevenmesh.com, and they're offering an exclusive 20% discount to all Downtime listeners. The new lineup boasts a vibrant array of new colours, as well as an updated version of their fan favourite GlidePath pant. I really like the old GlidePath pant, which is a lightweight, pedal-friendly trail pant designed for maximum comfort with a DWR coating to help them repel water. I've ridden in the new version in the last couple of weeks, and I can confirm that they've improved it with some subtle changes, adding a more secure fastening and an elasticated cuff, making it easier to get them on and off. They've taken an awesome, comfortable, lightweight trail pant and taken it up a notch. Well worth having a look. So if you're ready to enhance your riding experience this spring and summer, head over to 7mesh.com. That's the number 7 followed by the word mesh, and you can use the code DOWNTIMEX7MESH20 to enjoy 20% off. The offer has been proving super popular, and we're going to extend it until the 1st of May 2024. That's the code DOWNTIMEX7MESH20. Downtime, all lowercase, the letter X, the number 7, M-E-S-H, followed by the number 20. All right, just a couple of quick things before we get stuck into this week's episode. First off, make sure you never miss an episode by following the podcast. Just hit the follow button in your podcast app now, or find dedicated buttons for all the major platforms at downtimepodcast.com/follow. You can also keep up to date with what's going on by following us on Instagram and Facebook, where we're at Downtime Podcast. If you're hungry for more downtime, then you can join the newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter for exclusive behind-the-scenes insights, mountain biking snippets, product reviews, partner offers, and more. If you want to support the show, then you can join our Patreon over at patreon.com/downtimepodcast, or grab yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop. A massive thank you to everyone who supports the podcast in whatever way. It really does help, especially in challenging times like this year is proving to be. If you prefer to watch today's episode, you can check out the podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast. I'd really love it if you head over there, subscribe to the channel, and show the videos some love via likes and comments. All the links I've mentioned will be in the show notes for this episode on the website downtimepodcast.com. All right, today I'm joined by Ben Plenger from The Strength Factory, and we're diving headfirst into the world of mountain bike fitness, tackling some of the most pressing questions from you, the listeners. From battling arm pump to fine-tuning your nutrition and hydration strategies, we leave no stone unturned. Join us as we explore topics ranging from race day approaches to maintaining optimal shoulder health, and even how to tailor training for the younger riders out there. Plus, we'll be delving into the realm of supplements, helping you find the must-haves and avoid wasting money. Whether you're a seasoned rider or just starting out, this episode is packed with valuable insights and practical tips to help you conquer the trails with confidence. So, without further ado, here's Ben Plenger.
Ben Plenger, welcome back to the Downtime Podcast, mate. It's been a little while. How's life?
Yeah, I'm all good, thanks, Chris. It's great to be back, as always, in the misty, rainy Welsh valleys. well, not the valleys, but the North Wales valleys. Yeah, I'm great. Yeah.
Nice.
Spring is springing just about, despite today.
Yeah, well, we just went out for a little power hour on the bikes and didn't really feel like spring was springing, did it? But it was fun.
At least I was just wet and not cold and wet. So, you know, that means spring to me. All winter, I've been cold and wet, and now today I was just wet. So okay. let's be positive.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. So we're going to hit up listener questions. We had lots of them. We'll get through as many as we can. Before we do that, we're not medical professionals. We're not playing doctors on the internet. So yeah, if people want to change things up or like make sure that they're healthy, then make sure they consult the relevant medical professionals. Don't do anything silly, basically.
Yeah, basically. And then I guess the other thing I sort of want to say at the start is that whenever anyone asks me a training question online and maybe where I don't know the person or there's no context, like it's normally followed up by me then asking three or four more questions.
Yeah.
And so you say, and some of the questions I'll come to with that, and I'm going to try and explain my chain of thought and the considerations okay. that will not only help the person who asked that question, but someone who's listening whose question is similar but different.
Right.
And they can think, oh, okay, that's maybe how I should approach this issue
okay.
to solve my own problem.
Like it.
Exactly.
Rather than just saying, it depends.
Yeah, yeah, because that is the answer. It depends.
Yeah.
In which case, I don't think our listener numbers are going to be very good.
All right.
So, yeah.
Fair. Let's get stuck right into this. We'll not mess about. We'll tick off a biggie straight away. Quite a few people asking about arm pump. Seems to be like mountain bikers' worst nightmare. Lots of people struggle with it. And Wild AU MTB Trails on Instagram was keen to get some training advice to help his arm pump.
Arm pump. Yeah, we're starting with a tricky one there. So it is something that just some people seem to get and others don't seem to get. And whilst I think there's like a certain threshold of strength below which I think you're more liable to arm pump.
Yeah.
I think once you've reached like a basic threshold, like more strength doesn't mean less arm pump.
Okay.
You know? And in fact, you know, working with a lot of motocrossers and stuff like that, they are like, oh, if I do too much upper body work, I'll get worse arm pump and stuff like that. And there's a lot of kind of ideas and bro science and stuff like that. And so if I'm working directly with a racer generally who does have arm pump issues, mm-hmm. I guess we're just going to try out a lot of different avenues.
Okay.
And the first one is, yes, we're going to make sure that away from race season, they're strong. In their hands, their forearms and their upper body, but everywhere as well. Because I think that if your hips and back and posture is weak, then I think there's potentially more strain on your hands and that potential for arm pump. Mm-hmm. And so if we can make the whole system stronger and your riding position better, then we can potentially reduce arm pump from that point of view. But then as we get into the season, maybe they're doing a training camp where they're going to go and do longer, rougher trails, then I don't want them going into that with any fatigue in their forearms from the gym. So it's about, you know, do that work away from the times when arm pump is maybe more of an issue. Because mm-hmm. in the winter, maybe you're maybe not riding as long trails. You haven't gone to the mountains, you know. A lot of people are going to be riding more local trails that are shorter and arm pump's not an issue and things like that. And then, so then the other thing we think about is that recovery process and making sure that, you know, if you are training in the week and riding on the weekend, that, you know, can we relieve some tension from the forearms?
Okay.
You know, can we, now it's not so much foam rolling, but you can kind of self-massage or you can go and get some massage work done just to help the forearms recover, to sort of flush them out would be what you're looking for. You can use like the end of a barbell, like the, you know, the spinny bit on the bearings and sort of you lie on the mat and you can roll that and it's kind of cold metal seems to do a good job as well. and try and roll out the forearms and try and take that tension out of there. Cause you know, if you're training hard and getting a bit of arm, you know, your arms are sort of pumped up with blood in the gym and you're doing that regularly, then riding on the weekends, we just want to try and get that recovery going, okay, so they're fresh on the weekend. And this is something that you'll see if you sneak around the back of the pits at a World Cup is you're going to see pro riders getting their forearms rubbed down by physios, massage people, boyfriends, girlfriends, mates, mechanics probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Just getting them rubbed down to help get that recovery process going. There are other things that you can look at as well, and that's very much on an individual basis. And so if you try and understand that the nerves that supply your, the nerves that kind of control your hands and your forearm, they all originate up in your neck pretty much, and they come out the side of your neck. And so if someone's like really tense and, you know, worked up, or they've got neck problems, then it may manifest itself downstream, you know, into your forearms. And so maybe, and again, this would then go a bit beyond my scope as a coach and more to physio, but maybe, you know, we can get some work done on the neck area to relieve tension that then may have a positive effect downstream. And then I guess related to the first thing I said, I mean, skills coaching. I mean, there are a few top pro riders who complain a bit about arm pump, but there's not many, I think, compared to, you know, normal people. And that's because their technique's better, I think. And, you know, their bike's set up well and stuff like that. They're in a great position, and they're in a position that, that works for them, that means they're less likely to get arm pump.
Yeah, and I guess they're maybe not scared, tight. Like you, when you're riding, scared, you hold on tight naturally and all that.
Maybe you're like death gripping a bit too hard and stuff like that. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of different avenues that I would try. There's no, I'm sorry, but there's no one thing that I've ever found or done or read that's like, this will just fix it.
Yeah.
I think you've got to try a load of different stuff.
And also bike setup, right? You can try changing bar roll, bar width, grips, brake position,
brake strength.
Yeah.
All of that good stuff. Yeah, exactly.
Just
exactly.
Have a fiddle on the trails and see if anything helps. You'll know pretty quickly whether it's better or worse, right?
Yeah, for sure. And then I guess the other thing to think about is, you know, for a lot of people, they won't have arm pump maybe in the UK or where they wherever they live.
Yeah, okay.
But
yeah.
Then you go on your riding holiday. So I went to Morzine in the summer.
Yeah.
And I don't get arm pump. I get like finger and knuckle pain is what I get.
Yeah.
And on day one, it's horrendous. But actually, by second afternoon, it subsides. And by the end of the week, my palms are sore because I don't wear gloves. but other than that, it's fine. And so if you are doing a big trip like that and arm pump is going to potentially spoil that trip, then you need to get yourself to the bike park, you know, get in the car, drive wherever it is. So for me, I'd go to Bike Park Wales, where you can get some really demanding 4 to 5 minute long, rough tracks in.
Yeah.
Or Dovey Bike Park, you know, and if you can top to bottom those and they're 2 or 3 times as long as your local trails, then nothing conditions your hands and your body like riding.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool. Go riding. Like it.
Ride your bike more, basically. Yeah. Don't buy my programs. Just,
just go riding.
Go to Bike Park Wales.
Job done. All right. Another biggie theme that came out of this is like available time. Katie on email wanted to know how to balance training, working, recovery, etc., with a full-time job and avoid burning out.
Yeah. So I think this is the battle of modern world is available bandwidth mentally, emotionally, physically. And yeah, I always say, people say, oh, I need to find the time. You're never going to just, find the time magically. It's not just going to land in your lap. You need to make that time and carve it out. And yeah, cancel your Netflix, cancel your Amazon Prime, your Disney Plus, cancel those and let's see how much more time you've got straight away. And then it's, being creative with, you know, more people. I think I said this on the last podcast, but if you're working from home now and previously you commuted, that commuting time is training time that's just been given to you basically by the COVID shenanigans crisis that you didn't have before, but now you've got that time.
Yeah.
Don't just open your laptop earlier, like working for the man, just doing more nonsense. It's not that important. Look after yourself. Do some training. Go for a walk. You know, do some press ups. And then also, just don't underestimate the effectiveness of little and often, like small things done consistently. And if you are, you know, busy with work or your own business or a family, and you know, things like that, then carving out the big chunks of time is difficult.
Yeah.
And I understand that, and I experienced that at certain times through the year and over the last couple of years, you know, as a dad. But carving out little chunks regularly can really add up over time.
Yeah.
Like short 20-minute bodyweight workouts in the garden, in the garage or whatever, you know, a few basic bits of kit. But it just takes a bit of planning and a bit of organization so that when you've got that 20 minutes, you don't spend the first 5 minutes going, what should I do? I'm not sure, you know. So write something down, you know, plan it out, use a program, go on YouTube, whatever you do, make use of that time. So yeah, it's effective and you're not wasting it. And ring fence it. Get your calendar out on your phone or your paper diary at the start of the week. You know, generally at the start of my weeks, my weekly routine varies, mm-hmm. both in terms of the childcare I do and also the coaching I do. Some weeks I've got more clients in, some weeks fewer. And so then I look at my week, I'm like, okay, this week, da 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 da. And then I plan out which days, Monday to Friday, I'm going to do my riding, my training in the gym and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I literally write it down. And then it usually pretty much happens, you know, rather than just, you know, kind of drifting along, hoping it's gonna happen.
Yeah. You've got to make it easy to do, I guess, like almost harder to avoid than it is to do it. Like
yeah.
putting your gym bag in front of the door so you got to step over it when you go out, or
exactly.
Like, yeah, making it very obvious that you're supposed to be training or you're supposed to be going to the gym or going for a ride or whatever. Like, yeah. I find that really helps me.
Yeah, and just trying to make that environment, you know, if time is short and maybe you are training at home and stuff like that, then, you know, I have a pull-up bar in the garden and a set of kettlebells. They're cast iron kettlebells. They've lived outside for a decade. and they're still there. They haven't rusted away.
Yeah.
They may be a few grams lighter. And so all I need to do is open the back door and go outside. If I, you know, can't, I mean, I work at a gym so I can get to the gym, but yeah. do you know what I mean? Like yeah, yeah. if I want to do that bit extra, I can go and swing some kettlebells, do some squats, do some pull-ups. And I built a step up box again out of like treated plywood. It's been in the garden for about 5 years. It's nearly dead, but
yeah.
you know, it's but nearly it rotted. But it costs me peanuts.
20 quid or something to
yeah,
make.
Exactly. Yeah. And right there, I can just, anytime, and my wife uses it, and yeah. it helps us to have a healthy, fit, strong lifestyle, so we can do stuff and
yeah.
be good humans, like as I talk about all the time on here.
Yeah, and being a bit, for me anyway, being more structured in my day, like having a plan, like here's the hours I've got, here's the tasks I want to do, because I find if I don't have a plan, I'll drift, and
yeah,
before
yeah.
you know it, I've watched like 3 videos on YouTube that probably weren't particularly beneficial to me, and
yeah.
I've looked at some new sound equipment that I want to buy. Like, whereas if I've got a plan, I'm like, right, okay, that's done. What are yeah. we doing next? This.
And block out your time as well. I mean, yeah. And hopefully exercising, like riding and stuff like that, is a positive part of your day that you look forward to at some point. And you're like, right, okay. And for me, like being self-employed, and you, in fact, you know, I love what I do, but it can't, you know, it's a grind sometimes. And
yeah.
so I'm telling myself, right, I need to get these programs written and my weekly email to the main list. I need to get all of those done. And then once that's done, I can go and ride my bike for an hour mm-hmm. or whatever. Or once I've done that, then I'm going to do my, you know, and give yourself that little reward,
yeah.
You know, for the more mundane things.
Totally.
Yeah.
And another thing that's in that question from Katie is recovery. And that shouldn't be underestimated. I think I've been guilty of that in the past, but it's very easy to fill your diary with stuff and not always to fill your diary with some of the things your body needs, one of which is a bit of downtime, yeah. right?
That diary full of just stuff is, I think, quite common again. And it sounds like really judgy and like, who am I to say what's worthwhile for your time and things like that? But, you know, I think just do that time audit
yeah.
where you kind of appreciate what am I doing in the week and who for, and what for? And, you know, is there anything that I can trim here to, you know, regain some time, some autonomy and control, basically, that's then going to give me that bandwidth so I don't get run down. I'm not stressed out. And look, the whole stress thing is tricky because, like, hard exercise is a stress, but also at the same time, it's also that release, you know, and it's good for us, you know. All the studies, I know it's not quite stress, but all the studies that I've ever read show that exercise is more effective than prescription antidepressants at reducing symptoms of depression and stuff like that, you know. And so we've always got this toss up, and it just shows and reminds you that nothing's in isolation. So we're talking about fitness and stuff, but actually, you know, regardless of how much training and riding you're doing and stuff like that, you should still be sleeping well, and not on your phone like late at night, or like feeding that little dopamine devil on your shoulder that then keeps you up because now you're worried about something that you saw in a, you know, in a reel or a YouTube video about global warming. It's got you so stressed you can't fall asleep. And you got to eat as well, you know, you got to eat well. Like, everything ties in, you know, when you get those pillars of health and all tied together, then you can take the training.
You can do more.
You can endure like day-to-day life as well.
That's true. Yeah, get the balance right and you can actually get more done. Not easy, but
no
when you get it better, it's good.
But like all things worthwhile, it takes work.
Fair. All right, more time related questions. Back on Single Track on Instagram has come back to full-time work after having a baby and would like to know how best to spend 4 to 5 hours a week of like available time to do stuff, fitness stuff.
Yeah, well, that's a good chunk of time, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think like with that amount of time, you can make a lot of progress. And look, post-baby is a difficult time. And it also depends on, you know, how the birth was, whether it was like cesarean or whatever, and just appreciating and accepting, I guess, where your body is at that time.
Yeah.
And not feeling pressured by, oh, like Paula Radcliffe ran a marathon the week after having a baby, or, you know, this person, this influencer is like back in the gym, whatever. And everyone's going to have their own pace and you should take your time on that return, in particular paying attention to things like looking after your pelvic floor and things like that, if assuming that you don't want to, you know, have incontinence issues as you, if you go back to training too soon and things like that. So that's the first one. And if we assume that person, I can't remember the name,
back on single track,
yeah,
good name,
assuming that that she is on top of those things, then how do you spend your time? Well, for me, that non-negotiable is strength training and, you know, getting stronger for, you know, 2 to 3 of those hours a week is going to be the biggest bang for her buck, you know, in terms of quality of life and her riding, maintaining muscle and all that sort of stuff, and also help her to be a robust mum as the kid gets older and heavier and stuff like that, you know.
The one's thrown around.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then... yeah, let's just start building up that aerobic fitness. And then as and when you feel you can, let's just start to get those big rides in again, you know? And so it may be that 1 week you do like 2 hours of strength training, 1 hour easy, and then 2 hour ride on the weekend. But then another week, you know, or once you get a bit fitter, maybe more of that gets shifted when the weather's good to do a 3 hour ride on a weekend or something like that, you know, as you're able to do that. So it's a sliding scale, not fixed. And I guess the other thing I would say, if someone came to me in this position, is we would just get an appreciation of where the gaps are, where are the opportunities here, you know, in terms of what were they good at before they were pregnant and how much did they do through pregnancy, in order to appreciate where best to spend that time and energy.
Okay, got you. Another time related one. Tony on Instagram wants to know the best ratio of cardio to strength training in the winter, especially if you're not getting out on the bike much or at all.
Okay, yeah. So whenever it says best, I'm always like, oh, it depends. And then I'd follow up with loads of questions. And in a way, it's kind of similar to the last person there is, well, where are Tony's gaps? Mm-hmm. You know, is Tony naturally a bit of a lung on legs and he can always just ride all day and a slim build, maybe not so strong? Or is Tony a big, like, strapping lad who could, you know, pull up a tree stump and struggles to get up the hill, though, you know, because he's a big lad, you know, or something like that.
Runs
big, strong boy.
After an hour
So that is going to tell you the answer, really, is I think we all tend to be drawn to the things that we're good at.
Yeah.
Yep. So you'll naturally want to do, you know, that maybe sinewy, slim cross-country Tony will probably naturally want to do loads of riding, you know, and get the miles in, because that's what he's good at. And
do the cardio. Yeah.
And he won't maybe want to go to the gym, and then the other Tony's the other way around, you know. And so you need to do probably the things that you're not very good at. It would be a good place, good way to approach that, what is best for that person.
Yeah.
So what do I suck at? Oh, I suck at riding all day. Oh, okay, I need to do more miles. I need to get on the turbo trainer. I need to get outside. I need to get on Zwift or whatever it is. So I need to get some base miles. I need to do some intervals.
Yeah.
Maybe as part of that, I need to drop some body fat as well to help the watts per kilo go up and improve health along with it. But it may be that actually that's not the issue and they need to be stronger and they need to build some muscle. And so putting a proportion on it would just be arbitrary, I think. So sorry if I haven't answered the question.
It depends. But you've given, I think you've given a bit of a diagnostic.
Hopefully they can figure that out. And again, it's not fixed, it's sliding, you know? So yeah, we've just had the wettest February on record here in the UK. It's been horrendous. So I don't blame anyone here in the UK who's a bit down on their bike mileage, like I have been, because it's been soul destroying. But guess what? I'm feeling pretty strong in the gym at the moment because that's where I put more of my focus.
Yeah.
And now the last sort of week or 2 weeks, I've started to get, you know, the days have got a bit longer and it's been a bit warmer. And like today, I've been just like taking more opportunities to get out and prioritizing my time and my energy more on that as well. So it doesn't have to be fixed as well, you know, it can move through the winter.
Good work for making me accountable on riding as well, because I wouldn't have gone out in those
You
conditions.
Didn't want to go out, did you? But I wanted to ride these local trails here. It's an iconic hill here in Llangollen.
It is,
And I wanted to ride it, so it's good.
Fair play. Right, one more time related. Shane wanted to know what your personal split of weight training versus bike skills would be or is.
Cool. He said skills, so yeah. Okay.
Time on the bike, I guess. All time on bike is improving your skills, I think. But
yeah, so I kind of split that into two parts, like weekdays, school days, and weekends.
Yeah.
So first of all, in the week, like guaranteed every week, I do two strength sessions in the week. And then sometimes, depending on how much I'm riding, I do a third. Okay, and they're all whole body sessions. I generally don't do like bro splits with like leg day and stuff like that.
Similar to the way you program, basically.
Just like I program for my online programs and my athletes. It's like whole body workout, single leg, bit of push, bit of pull, bit of strength, maybe a bit of power, bit of core, happy days. So two as like my default baseline, sometimes three, like in February when the weather's been shit. And then, and then the time in the week then gets topped up with maybe a session on the watt bike or on the gravel bike or today on the e-bike or more going into summer. You know, I did a bit of night riding, over the winter, you know, pedaling, and I'll start to do more evening trail rides and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it really varies, but basically, when work and family allows, I will do as much riding as I can in the week, basically, of one sort or another. And then the weekends just really depends on what's on the schedule. And probably 2 out of 3 weeks, I'll get a Saturday or a Sunday morning, like a 3-4 hour block.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit longer, including driving.
Yeah.
not every week, sadly, these days. You know, we've got to take kids swimming and all that business, visit family. Just life happens, doesn't it? Yeah. So that's where I'm at.
Okay. And what of that ride time, would you say there's a certain or a rough percentage where you're really focused on like technique or kind of sessioning areas, or is it more just like going out for a ride?
So I'd say that I'm always wary that it makes it sound like I'm not having fun, but I honestly think about my riding pretty much every time I go riding.
Okay.
I was thinking about it today.
Yeah.
It was really slippery and I felt a bit out of tune with my e-bikes. I've been pedaling lots. I haven't e-biked much recently. Yeah. And I was really thinking as very slippery trails, like how to make this e-bike like work today. Mm-hmm. I was consciously thinking about it. And I do that a lot. I do ride on my own a lot as well,
yeah,
which I really like. Yeah. In the week, self-employed as well. I can't always find a riding buddy. And those rides in particular, that's where I consciously think about my riding and try to improve. And then a weekend ride with the boys is normally just like trying to go as fast as I can and forgetting all the good habits,
yeah.
Braking too late, stand it up in the turns, no exit speed, like, you know, the standard stuff we do when we're trying to keep up with faster mates, basically.
Like it. All right. We've got a fair few nutrition-based questions. We'll start with Ollie, who says, on big days, he takes lunch and a few snacks, but he normally bonks before lunch and again towards the end of the day. Can you talk a bit about like carb intake requirements to help Ollie avoid those issues?
Yeah, so I think I know this, Ollie. This is Ollie, aka the secret shredder.
Okay.
Low key, but very fast.
Okay.
So the first thing I'd say is if that's becoming an issue, then let's go back a step, you know, before the ride.
Yeah.
What are you having for dinner the night before and breakfast on the day of the ride? And can we increase total carbohydrates in particular, but maybe just calories as a whole? But we want those muscles and your system basically packed with carbs, which is going to be the primary fuel for most group rides, basically, where, you know, it's a bit too intense to just run on fat, basically, as a fuel. And, you know, if you've had like a big day at work or you've done some training or another ride the day before and then you haven't replenished those stores, so those glycogen stores, which is a stored carbohydrate, and straight away you're going to be behind the curb. So let's get that, you know, extra few potatoes with dinner, extra scoop of rice, you know, a bit of fruit after dinner, stuff like that. And again, with breakfast, you know, can we get an extra bit of toast or some porridge and, you know, or whatever it is to bump up the carbohydrate of that meal.
Yeah.
And then once you're riding, if you know you're going to be out all day, then and you've had issues with running out of energy, then start eating or drinking carbs, basically, before you're hungry, before you feel you need it. I think too often people, they're just like having a great time. Yeah. They're riding along, especially I think in the winter, like we never seem to drink enough either, and stuff like that. And then before you know it, you start eating or consuming energy and carbs, basically, once it's a bit too late, you know? So just have that, right, I've got two bars and a gel for the morning, you know, that's going to get me to lunch.
Yeah.
And, you know, that first bar is after a couple of drops, like 45 minutes or an hour in, you know? So get on it earlier. And then thinking about what you actually eat on the day in terms of bars, packed lunch, real food, sports nutrition, and stuff like that. A good way to think about it, Chris, is the more intense the work you're doing on that ride. So for instance, if you were doing a cross country race or like a marathon race, or, you know, it's just gonna be a fast pace, you're gonna be grafting all day. The more intense it is, the more important and the more specific your nutrition will need to be, because it's gonna need to be higher carbohydrate as a proportion, and also lower in fat, protein and fiber, okay? Because those things slow down digestion and can also make, you know, it's going to sit in your tummy. If you're working hard, you're just not going to digest them.
Yeah.
The slower the ride, so just like a chilled all day loop around the hills with some friends where there's lots of stops, or a cafe stop. You know, the more we go to that end of the scale, the more freedom you've got to eat real food.
Yeah.
And to have, you know, things that have got some fat, or a little bit of fat, or a little bit of protein or fiber and things like that in them. So I think you just need to appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, so a good one is, you know, trail mix. Yeah. It's called trail mix, and it's probably an ideal food for walking on trails.
Yeah.
But you quite often see people pull out like a little bag of like nuts and raisins and stuff on a mountain bike ride. You're like, those nuts are doing nothing for you
it's
here.
It's just fat, right?
Yeah, it's just fat, quite a bit of fiber, a little bit of protein. And look, it's tasty. I love trail mix. And it's kind of satisfying as well. And it's nice to not just have sweet stuff, and maybe it's a bit salty. Mm-hmm. But actually, on the mountain bike, something like that, it's not really ideal unless you've got a very slow, very long drawn out pace or multi-day, you know.
Okay.
So, yeah, try and be higher carb. And the faster you're going, the more specific it needs to be, the more moderate your pace, the more freedom you've got to eat real food, like to have a sandwich, you know, or just a supermarket cereal bar rather than the sports nutrition, expensive bars and gels and stuff like that, which are a really effective and really valuable part of the game.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily need those all the time.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, the rule of thumb that I've worked to on the more intense, bigger days is 1 gram of carbohydrate per kilo of body weight every hour after the first hour. So for me, like 75 odd grams of carbs an hour, which is actually fairly hard to do.
Yeah.
So I tend to break it down. It works out about 3 sort of products an hour after the first hour. So I just set a 20-minute alarm on the Wahoo that beeps at me. And it just reminds me, like, you should have something to eat now.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've tended to use kind of sports nutrition stuff, but also Jelly Babies I found are pretty good. Like,
love that.
Sweets and things on Stone King Valley, loads of Haribo.
Yeah, that's good.
Actually, like, kind of a bit of a lifesaver from an energy perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really great guide. I mean, I think the general guidance for intense like cardiovascular exercise would be 60 to 90 grams of carbs per hour. Mm-hmm. I mean, interestingly, if we go like properly down the rabbit hole here, is like Tour de France sort of average speeds and things like that have gone up the last few years, and hopefully the ride, you know, they're actually pretty close to when it was really dirty, and hopefully they're all clean now, hopefully. But they're kind of reaching those speeds again. And with all the rules about bikes and stuff, it's not the bike. And yeah, there's some advancements in training. And actually, I think a lot of it, and I've read quite a few articles about this, saying that they've new supplements with ratios of fructose to glucose and stuff like that, and meaning that riders can consume more carbohydrate than ever before.
Yep.
And these tiny, these smaller, lightweight guys who are like maybe 70 kilos are consuming over 100 grams of carbs an hour now.
Yeah, quite easily as well. Yeah. Like, the new stuff.
Exactly, which wasn't thought possible before, and it would make you sick. And people would have like stomach issues, you know, cramps or diarrhea, even sickness. So if you are, you know, maybe doing marathon racing or like really long, intense, but even cross country race, you know, you need to be consuming that for an hour to 90 minute XC race. You need to be getting like gels and energy drinks on and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'd say for most like amateur racers, you don't want to be going over 100, like, because you actually physically need to train your gut to do that.
Yeah.
So they will have as part of their training plan, will be this ride will be a high fuel ride, mm-hmm. where they're training to tolerate more without basically just sharting their chamois, for want of a better word. Nice. So if you are serious about it, and you need to train your gut by having progressively more carbohydrate.
Fair play. Interesting. I use the OTE Supercarb, which is fairly new, on Stone King Rally, which is an easy 80 grams of carbs in a 500ml bottle of water. Mm. And it was incredible. Like, it was a real lifesaver. So yeah, there are some good like high carb products around, but yeah, don't the first time you use it, should not be at a race.
Golden rule. Yeah. Golden rule for any supplement or anything at a race. A race should just be doing familiar things in a more intense environment, basically.
Yeah. Well, that leads us on to Shane, actually. So he wants to know, he said he's struggling to find food and drink that sits well with him on big rides or on enduro race days, and wants to know your top three trail bag food items.
Ah, cool. Ah, nice. Well, that worked out nicely. I've already given him a bit of a hint there. So, I think as you just touched on there, don't always just think food then. If you're struggling to get things to sit well, then maybe Sean would benefit from getting some of his carbohydrate and calories from a liquid form, you know, from an energy drink, like that OTE one. I use like Beta Fuel, mm-hmm. And I just like the flavor and stuff like that. And so finding what works for you is a frustrating process of trial and error, you know, and trialing it on a big intense weekend ride, or maybe I always encourage people to do like a race simulation day or weekend before the season, mm-hmm. where you practice your warm up, your nutrition, what you have for breakfast and all that sort of thing. And so it's thinking with that plan, you know, it's this balance of real food and sports nutrition and so on, and thinking about, right, let's sort of lay it out on the table maybe, or get a pen and pad.
Yeah.
And maybe for him, it's all the sweet stuff. You know, certainly at the end of an enduro race, all I want is a bag of like salty crisps or chips for the North Americans, you know, because I've had all these bars and gels and stuff. I just want something salty on some chips. But maybe he takes something savory, like some savory rice cakes or something like that, which don't always travel well. They get a bit crushed up often. But maybe that's the answer there, you know, something like that to balance out all the sweet stuff.
Yeah.
And drinking a bit of the energy, the carbohydrate as well. And then just trying different brands, you know. It's like I just plugged that SIS Beta Fuel because I really like the taste of it. I do not like their gels, the Beta Fuel gels. Yeah. I thought, oh, they're gross. Yeah. Like, you couldn't pay me to eat those. And I like the ones from Talk, you know, or High Five. They do some really tasty mango gels. And just, you just have to try some different bits, you know, to find what works.
Yeah.
I'm afraid I don't have a magic answer to that, except for trial and error, and maybe try some having some savory bits in there to balance out all the sweet stuff.
Yeah, and shifting carb over to drink, or at least put a portion of the carb over to a drink-based product. For me, that was it makes life a lot easier. It's a lot easier to consume for me because I struggle to eat towards the end of longer rides.
Yeah. And also, I guess having a bit of a plan, maybe if you're racing enduro, or even if you're not, if you're just on a big ride with like big long climbs and big descents, is something, assuming that the climbs are a moderate pace, I try, and this works for me, and I've suggested it to many racers and it's worked for them mostly, is solid food at the bottom of the stage, mm-hmm. and then liquid and gel food at the top of the hill.
Yeah.
You know? So you're not having your cereal bar or half a sandwich at the top before you drop into the stage. You get to the bottom and you're a bit out of breath. It's not ideal. Like, you hang in probably if you've been racing, but you know, right. So solid food at the bottom, and as you get up the hill closer to the race stage, you go more liquid energy and gel and try that strategy.
Makes sense. Can get expensive, and someone's mentioned, should they put salt or sugar in their water when they ride? Is that like a way to help some of both the hydration and the energy side of things without spending loads?
It depends. I mean, it depends. So, what they're asking basically, so salt, we're talking about electrolytes, like those hydration tabs basically.
Yeah.
Or sugar, an energy drink effectively, you know, or you can just do it old school. That's what people did. Mm-hmm. They bit of squash or whatever, some salt and sugar, shake it all up, and you've got a homemade drink. So I guess the first answer is, why choose? You can have both. Like most energy drinks, will have electrolytes or salts in it.
Yeah.
But then it's also putting it in the context of your, and it sounds really serious, but your fueling strategy, Chris. It's a bit Formula One.
That makes sense. Yeah, you need to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That fueling strategy. So if I am getting all the fuel I need, the carbohydrate I need from food, then maybe I just have the salt, like an electrolyte tab in the water. Maybe actually your more moderate ride all day is made up of like more real food. So you've got a sandwich, you've got some cereal bars, and there's no sports nutrition, but actually guess what? Your sandwich, it's got a load of salt in it, in the bread.
Yeah.
And so do those bars and stuff like that. And you might just have water in your bottle, you know? So, you know, it's about finding the gap, I guess. Do you need to fill a gap with the bottle? You might do. You might need more carbs in the bottle. You might need the electrolyte tab in the bottle.
Yeah.
And also everyone's different. I mean, I most of the time like to ride with just water in my bottle. Mm-hmm. I find it the most refreshing. And I also know that I'm not a big sweater. I'm not, and I don't, when I sweat, I don't have loads of salt all over my jersey.
Yeah, not white high salt. Sodium sweater,
exactly. Like after your podcast quite a few years ago with Precision Hydration, I went and had a sweat test with them. Oh, so nice. I was interested.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, you're like at the low end of all of this stuff. And actually their products were really nice. They were tasty, but I didn't need any of their high salt products.
The 1500.
For really. But if you're someone who really struggles, you sweat loads, you get all the white marks on your jersey, then you need to go down that route. You need to find a product with high salt in it.
Yeah.
Those higher concentrations of electrolytes.
Yeah. Now they're now called Precision Hydration and Nutrition, I believe.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
And they're doing some nutrition products and doing some mixed products with electrolyte and carbs in. Cool. So they've got some cool stuff to check out as well, actually.
Nice. Happy to have free plug. They can send us some free shit.
There you go. And so my approach again on the big rides was energy in the bottle, electrolytes in my backpack, and then food, gels, blah, blah, blah as well. So I knew how much of each I was consuming. It helped to keep it kind of separate. But
perfect.
Yeah. You have to find something that works for you so you know where you're at.
And when I went at the Enduro I did last summer, I did the Southern Champs at Minehead down in Somerset. And as part of the course, you got to ride past the car park and the van. So I rode with water in my bottle, which is my preferred thing.
Yeah.
But I had a bottle made up in the van, in the cool box, with energy drink. Made to like a fairly strong concentration, and that in that 10 minutes there, I went back to the van, cooled off in the shade, and I hit probably 50 or 60 grams of carbs from that bottle and topped up my other bottle with water and carried on. And so it's about figuring out your strategy for the day. And or even when you stop at a cafe. You stop at a cafe, they call, roadies call a can of Coke? They call it the red ambulance, don't they? Because it saves you when you're bonking. It's that can of Coke.
Yeah.
That 35.
Caffeine and sugar,
35 grams of sugar. Yeah. Bosh. Whoa, I'm good
ready
again.
To go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not the most glamorous and it's maybe not the most exciting, but for me anyway, and I've worked with a few other people that have got this stuff sorted out now as well, it makes a huge difference. You think, I'm not fit, I can't do that ride. Mm. And then you get your nutrition right and you're like, that ride was actually pretty easy.
It does
make a massive difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. Worth looking into. All right. A bit more food-based stuff. Reggie wants to know what your day-to-day diet looks like. So maybe you can break that down a little bit of sort of sharing how you think about what you consume rather than the specific. This much cheese. And
So how I think about it. I mean, I would just say, to me, it's just a real food, minimally processed omnivore is what I am.
Okay.
So I eat meat and fish and dairy, fruit, nuts, seeds, vegetables. I pretty much only drink water and coffee.
Yeah.
water and coffee these days. So it's nothing kind of remarkable, except that I do put like time and effort in to, like, we cook dinner like 7 days a week pretty much, and I get up a bit earlier, and I'm breakfast monitor in our house.
Okay.
To make sure that we're getting the things we need, and I probably eat like more meat and more protein than maybe a lot of people would, and some people will probably criticize for the environment and things like that. I don't think it's as crystal clear as maybe the mainstream narrative would lead us to believe, but I think that's for a different podcast.
I agree.
We'll leave that there, just delicately cast aside. But I do try to consume a pretty high protein diet, and I've said it on here before, and I'll say it again because I think people need reminding, is that aim for that 2 grams of protein per kilo of body weight most days.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if you can start ticking that off with a higher protein breakfast, and, you know, however you get your protein, for me, it's primarily meat, you know, and eggs, actually.
Yeah.
Then that's it. Now, in terms of how I eat as well, I guess there is a seasonal aspect to a certain extent as well, which I think is a good thing, where in the winter, you want that more warming stuff. And, you know, the way our schedule works out is every Wednesday all winter, the slow cooker goes on and it's full of like root vegetables, like swede and leeks and all that good stuff. And then usually something with like a bone in it and, you know, and connective tissue and skin, all the good stuff that some people are squeamish about, but that has been the healthiest part of humans' diets for millennia.
Yeah.
Like literally. And for all of, you know, Liver King's craziness and steroid use, you know, trying to eat more organ meats and, you know, marrow and just that bony broth, you know, every Wednesday, all the goodness that comes out of those bones, if I get like a oxtail or something like that.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. And I think that's probably our healthiest meal of the week for my family. And it's a battle getting the kids to eat it sometimes. Sometimes they come home and cry. They're like, no, it's stew,
it's
daddy.
It's Wednesday.
Yeah. They're like, they just want fish fingers or something. Yeah. But we try. And then I guess in the summer, I don't want that. I don't want a roast dinner on a Sunday. And in the summer, we tend to eat more, like a lot more salads and raw vegetables and, you know, peppers and tomatoes and that stuff.
Yep.
And that works out well as well in terms of the environment, because it means that, you know, it's mostly grown from the UK or, you know, maybe Spain. You know, we're not getting stuff flown all over the world. I think to me it's nothing remarkable. But then on the other hand, there's nothing I really like deny myself in a way. I mean, it's like I eat like bread and toast with butter on, and if I want a treat, I have a treat, and I eat lots of chocolate at Christmas, and it's Easter soon. I have a treat on the weekend. I generally don't drink much these days, but if I want a drink, I'll have a drink. You know, I'm not a teetotal. And yeah, so I think, I don't know if that's answered it or not, but to me, it's just real food is the key.
Yeah.
Whatever you choose that to be, there's very little like processed and ultra processed food in mine and my family's diet. Like, and it takes some effort. I cook every day. So, I mean, thinking about I guess that's what you always should take from any of this stuff that I say. Ben says this, so what? Someone online says it, so what? The so what should be, maybe I need to learn to cook, or maybe just things, how can I make it easier to prepare my own food? Whether it's figuring out my weekly routine so I can actually source it in the first place, or get it delivered, or get a veg box once a week, or a subscription where you get like steaks once a month, or whatever it is, cooking's so hard. Well, it's really hard because your knives are all blunt and your pan sticks.
Yeah.
Get a knife sharpener and a decent pan.
Oh, slow cooker,
or a slow cooker, and you literally just put it all in the morning, and at tea time the house smells amazing, and you've got a great meal.
Yeah.
Or I don't have one, but everyone's raving about these air fryers. Get a bloody air fryer.
Yeah.
Just instead of putting chicken goujons and fucking all the other nonsense in the air fryer, put some actual bits of chicken in it, or fish, or, you know, a whole tray of roasted vegetables.
Yeah.
That can then give you enough to have a bit of lunch tomorrow, some leftovers, you know?
Okay.
Again, I think people always want me to just say, oh, well, this is one thing you can eat and it'll be all right. But it's bollocks, isn't it?
It is. Like, there's no easy answer.
Yeah, there's no easy answer. And it depends. If you want to put value on your health, then you need to put effort into it.
Yeah.
And I don't apologize for saying that.
Fair. So I think, yeah, to summarize then, real food, cooked from scratch, lots of variety, 2 grams per kilo body weight protein.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sort of, if you try and do that, you're probably going to be pretty good.
And on that 2 grams, just to clarify, sorry, if anyone listening is, or if anyone full stop is, you know, if you're overweight, you know, maybe you're 10, 20 kilos overweight, then you should try and use what you think your healthy weight might be.
Right.
Otherwise, you're going to really struggle to hit that protein target.
Yeah, okay.
And then also potentially, and your calories are going to bump up loads.
Okay, so the kilogram figure you're calculating from should be
roughly a healthy-ish weight.
Fighting fit weight. Rather than,
so if you're like a, you know, 100 kilo guy, but you think that, you know, 10 years ago I was 90 kilos and felt quite good, then work off 90 kilos, you know, or whatever.
Good advice. All right. Richard on email has an active job, does heaps of riding by the sounds of it. He says he's burning 4,500 calories a day on active days, which is a lot. And he's finding it hard to feed that need basically without resorting to bad food because that's easy, right? Any advice?
Yeah, that's
similar to what we've been talking about. But
yeah, same but different, but maybe the opposite problem, well, the complete opposite problem to loads of people who don't move enough.
Yeah.
You know, they're getting fewer steps, they're sat at home, working from home. So what we need to think about is calorie and energy density of your food. And also, let's start with that. And so first of all, you need to understand that protein and carbs have roughly 4 calories per gram.
Mm-hmm.
Fat is 8, double. Yeah.
Okay.
So what we want to do is that the first thing I would look at doing is trying to increase a bit of fat in the diet,
mm-hmm.
like primarily from, you know, healthier fats. I mean,
avocado.
Yeah, you know, and nuts and things like that. I mean, yeah, look, from meat as well, from dairy, like some full fat dairy and stuff like that as well. Unless maybe there are like family issues with cholesterol and things like that, in which case I'd go, you know, speak to a switched on forward thinking doctor, maybe not.
Yeah.
Because I think that whole cholesterol thing is, ideas I think are changing quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I'm not well informed enough to talk more about it than really, except to speak to someone. And so, you know, obviously, can we pack a bit more into breakfast? So let's say, you know, let's say they're having porridge for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Rich, was it? Rich having porridge for breakfast?
Richard,
Richard, sorry. And there's different ways we can make that. We can, you know, make it with water and a pinch of salt, like some Scottish sheep farmer 100 years ago. Or we can make it with milk.
Yeah.
And then we can jazz it up. We can add a bit of fruit. Not many calories, but good for you. We can add maybe a spoonful of coconut oil.
Yeah.
You know, big dose of calories, healthy fats, other potential benefits from there as well.
Yeah.
And or some peanut butter,
mm-hmm.
bumps up the calorie content. You know, straight away there, we can take porridge from being a few hundred calorie breakfast to 700 or 800 calorie breakfast,
mm-hmm.
you know. In a similar way, things like making up some sort of protein smoothie or something like that you could take with you in the morning to get your blender out, a couple of scoops of protein and a bit of yogurt. Again, like stuff like nut butters are really handy because they're so calorie dense. And they're good at filling you up, and then you get some like chia seeds in there, whatever. Just go like mad in that aisle of the supermarket, which can get a little bit expensive. But then you've also got things like off the shelf, higher calorie recovery products, you know, where, you know, maybe they're sold as like mass gainer, like weight gain 3000 or whatever, like Cartman and that sort of thing. But actually, you know, in the past I've used a product that's, you know, it's a protein, but then it's got a load of really finely milled oats in it as well.
Okay.
And so you'd have a shake after training and it was like 40 or 50 grams of protein and also about the same again, of carbs, and I think it came in at like 400 or 500 calories post training.
Okay, nice.
Which isn't a great idea if you're a smaller person with an inactive job or you're overweight. But if you are really active, struggling for enough calories, losing weight or muscle or whatever, then that's going to be really effective for you.
Okay.
So I mean, the answer, we all know the answer is eat more, isn't it, Richard?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, just finding the good versions of the eat more rather than the Domino's pizza or...
Exactly, or just stopping at the garage and buying 2 Mars bars and a pack of Doritos, you know? And so I think that there's got to be that preparation, or just, you know, appreciating, you know, figuring out in your area where you live or where you work, where are the places where I can source some good food, you know, for lunch and stuff like that. And it might take a little bit of effort to figure that out.
Yeah, few and far between, I find. Generally, you've got to be on top of it and take your what you need with you rather than rely on service stations and all of that.
But. Yeah, and that stuff's got better these days. Like in the UK, we've got the Marks and Spencers and the Waitrose services.
Yeah.
You know, it does get expensive, though.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid that, it goes back to the last one, that, you know, preparation.
Yeah.
It's got to be where it's at. Big breakfast. So by sounds it, he probably does have a big breakfast already.
If you're putting in 4,500 calorie days, you're probably starting off.
Yeah, it's healthy. A big shift.
Yeah. All right, we've got a few questions around shoulders. They seem to be pretty common for injuries. People want to bulletproof them. Some people are struggling with like overhead work due to past injuries like shoulder separations, collarbone breaks. Mm-hmm. Very common mountain bike thing. Trees and the ground tend to attract our shoulders on a regular basis. Shoulder related advice, I guess, both for people looking to strengthen and bulletproof and then also looking to work around injuries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So I think the evidence anyway, I don't know if you remember a few years ago when it was still the Enduro World Series, they did some really good work into like athlete health and stuff like that with their athlete survey. And shoulders were, the including collarbones, were the most injured part for Enduro World Series riders over like whichever period they monitored it for, by quite a way as well, as I remember. It was a few years ago. So that's the first one, is to appreciate that this is a thing.
Yeah.
And certainly the people who come and see me at the gym when I take an injury history, it's like, collarbones, shoulders, closely followed by wrists. Normally.
Yeah.
it is what it is. So first things first, if you've had an injury, do your physio. Like do those boring band exercises. I can't pretend they're exciting or jazzy or anything, but actually, if you go and see a physio, whether it's through your health service or privately, depending on where you live, and they give you some exercises, just do them. Like, seriously, it will do you no end of good, okay? And then beyond that, it's then about gradually understanding where your limitations are in terms of what you can do and how you can move your shoulders and how strong they are, and then keep like bumping up against that, you know, without it being painful or detrimental. So, you know, post shoulder injury, or even if it's just like a small one where you've had a knock and you don't really need treatment for it, but you can't quite do what you used to do, is we always just want to train like around it and as close up to it as possible in terms of the weight you use or the positions you're in.
Yeah.
So maybe you used to be able to just press straight overhead standing up, but now you can't quite get there. And so we want to just, by working right up to it closely, we can then gradually improve what we're capable of. And then it gradually works back, hopefully, to where we were or where we want to be.
Yeah.
Rather than just like meathead, you know, just grit my teeth, push through the pain, which, especially with shoulders, they're so complex, is rarely going to work out for you.
Yeah.
So how do we actually go about doing that then? Especially if you think about a standing shoulder press, I mean, and then you can't do that. The thought of pressing it at 45 degrees from the body, that's actually incredibly difficult. And so what we're going to use is some different exercises that are going to be a bit kinder on the shoulder in terms of the angles and the direction.
Okay.
So the first one that I'll suggest people Google is something called a landmine press, where you could do it kneeling or standing, and you've got a barbell basically, and the weight is only on one end and the other end's on the floor or in a corner of a room
or in a landmine
attachment. Yeah. Exactly. And so it pivots like a big lever bar basically. Yeah. And you push that up and it kind of goes 45 degrees out from your, your body, or you can make it, depending on where you sit or stand, you can adjust that angle. And that's a great place to start, because we start to work those shoulder muscles. And, you know, if you pay attention to your position, there's a little bit of instability there, like side to side, but not as much as a dumbbell or kettlebell. And so that's a really great place for people to start strengthening that. And it works in a safe, what we would call plane of motion, like the direction is going to be safe for, and appropriate for most people. Similarly, we could go to a bench, an adjustable bench in a gym, and we could, you know, sit it not quite in the upright position, but like one hole back. So you're leaning back like, I don't know, 10 degrees, let's say, who knows what it is. But you're still going to be pressing vertically. The weights are moving vertically, but effectively that is a less now demanding angle than if you were sat vertically of your spine, you know? And it may be that you can't even do that first hole. Maybe to start with your two holes back, you know, and so you're closer, a little closer to a chest press than a shoulder press. But that's fine. We're just going to keep working in that direction until you can do it in the vertical position or standing or kneeling or whatever. So we can then apply the same thing, because obviously we want to push and pull with the upper body to be strong and to be robust, with pulling. So initially, you may not be able to do a pull-up or a chin-up due to strength or mobility. You may not even be able to hang on a bar, but you might be able to use like the lat pull-down machine and just lean yourself back a bit and pull more into like the mid-chest, you know? So we work more of the mid-back, and the angle is just going to work for you. Or, you know, if you don't have that machine, then you can do a similar thing. You can set up some bands, or, you know, you could switch from a pull-up, which is an overhand grip where your palms face away, to a chin-up, which is a narrower grip where your palms face you. And you can kind of lean back from the bar a bit there. And for a lot of people, that will be workable, where a pull-up isn't, you know. So it's about figuring out, these are the positions that I can adopt, that I can train in now, that are going to make me stronger and gradually help me move me back. Other things that you can do that are really beneficial, generally, I would say, or generally here, you know, consult your physician, things like maybe like crawls and things like that, you know, where your shoulders are, you know, you're doing a bear crawl on the floor, and there's various different positions, different difficulties, where every time you put your hand down, your shoulder is in a slightly different position, like relative to your body and space. And so, and we've got a lot going on in terms of core work and stability and things like that. And that's a great way to build confidence in your shoulders again. As well as that strength and endurance and control. And then I guess finally, we can do, you know, maybe a little more advanced as well, as part of a end of a rehab process or as part of a prehab process for that, you know, bulletproofing in inverted commas there, is you could do something called a bottoms up press, where you hold a kettlebell upside down. So, you know, you don't need much. It might only be a 4 or an 8 kilo kettlebell. You crush that handle, Chris. And so that the bell is above the handle now. So it's unstable. And you're going to press that overhead or as close as you can, or using a bench. And all that instability is generally a really positive thing for, you know, creating that stability in the shoulder that's part of the picture of building a robust shoulder that can train hard, that can ride hard, and that may or may not be a little bit better if you fall off your bike. Because we can't prevent injuries.
No, but it can
we
help.
We all know.
Yeah.
But it can help.
Are we differentiating between pain and discomfort here? So I've been through a shoulder injury recently, and I've found that working in areas of slight discomfort is actually beneficial, and you see quite big improvements in mobility as a result. And but there's a differentiation for me, I think, between discomfort and pain.
Yeah, I think you've summed that up really nicely there, Chris. Where, you know, discomfort, just when we nudge up to the, nudge up close to the painful positions, but, you know, pain is sharp, isn't it? It's like, oh, you know, it backs you away. You flinch away from it physically and, you know, in your reaction. But yeah, that discomfort, I think, is part of that process. Unless, you know, maybe who knows, close post-surgery and stuff like that. Yeah, but then you're getting advice from, you know, your physio or your doctor 100%. Or whatever. But that sort of uncomfortable positions. It's like, in, you know, if you want to get stronger, you need to be a bit uncomfortable. You know, if it's always easy, you're not going to get stronger. If you want to do improve your fitness through interval training or just long, hard rides, you've got to be uncomfortable. But we don't want that sharp, stabbing pain. Yeah. That's never good.
Something's wrong. All right, good stuff. We had a question about recommendations for training when perimenopausal. Any advice or thoughts on that?
Cool. So I'll be straight. I had to do some research here because off the top of my head, I didn't really know.
Okay.
And the first thing I would say as well is that for any women listening, the resources I always will send people to, and I think probably one of the better resources on the internet in terms of fit, active women at all stages of their life is Dr. Stacey Sims.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And her book, Raw, R-O-A-R, and her website and all that sort of thing is an amazing resource. I've got it, you know, I've read it a few years ago. Actually, I should probably dig it out again, have another read. But yeah, that is where I would go for a start, rather than, you know, it's good that people are talking about these subjects more, about, you know, women's and athletes' sort of menstrual cycle, menopause, post-childbirth, and it shouldn't be taboo. It's like every woman that we know is going to experience these things. Your mum, your wife, your sister, your daughter, you know. But along with that goes a lot of nonsense, basically, you know, especially in like pull out Sunday supplements in the newspaper and tabloid clickbait nonsense, and a lot of people will prey on this stuff. So yeah, go and check out. We'll get a link to that in the notes.
We will,
So I guess the main thing to take away from it, as I understand it anyway, is that at that perimenopausal time, which is just like where the transition starts to happen, is that that is kind of not your last chance, but if you're not strength training and doing things to minimize muscle loss and bone density loss, if you're not doing it, then now is really when you need to start. Because once that menopause has happened and the changes to your body composition happen and your hormones happen, all of that becomes so much harder to make those meaningful changes to muscle mass, which is incredibly important for long-term health.
Yeah.
Bone density, which is a bigger issue for women than men.
Yeah.
And so on. So if you don't already do some strength training, and I'm not trying to sell you anything, all right? If you don't, then now you need to do it.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. Because now at this point, as I understand it again, the perimenopausal woman is able to make a good amount of progress still because of her like hormonal state and the condition that her body is in, to build and maintain muscle and bone density that then sets her up to have a smoother transition to menopause and potentially as well, you know, reducing some of the sort of symptoms effectively of menopause.
Interesting.
So maybe I... You know, that was like the main thing I took away, really. And then I thought afterwards, when I was thinking about this before, I'm like, is this just like the Ben echo chamber where I'm drawn to the strength training one? But like, that seemed to be the main takeaway from a couple of, you know, a few things I read.
Yeah.
So get in the gym.
Okay.
And we'll get strong.
Yeah, we'll put that resource in the show notes. Yeah, we'll link
to Dr. Stacey Sims.
Good stuff. All right. Nice one. Lance on email wants you to talk about approach to training through challenges and how to know whether to lay off or keep pushing. And I think that's both injury and illness related he's talking about there.
Yeah. Cool. So I guess one sentence answer is only train when you can gain.
Okay.
So if you feel rotten, think, if I do this training session, am I actually going to be fitter, stronger after this, or am I going to be more run down, more rotten feeling, and make this illness last longer? And normally, if you really rationally deal with that in your head, then you know the answer is generally to rest. What normally happens is that people are worried about losing all their gains. Athletes are terrified because they turn on their phone and everyone else is training twice as hard and they're riding. And, oh my God, oh, now I've got to keep pushing, you know, or I don't want to be seen as weak or whatever. But yeah, that's as simple as it is, really. I mean, in terms of being a little more specific, you know, through the winter, it's easy to pick up like a little sniffle or a little cold and stuff like that. And a good guideline there is if it's your neck and above, mm-hmm. like it's just in your head or maybe like the back of your nose or throat and it's not too bad, then you might be all right to do some training, just maybe more moderate training. Don't do really hard intervals.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you could do some low-key aerobic work, cut down the duration a bit, or you might be fine to strength train, you know. Anything below the neck, i.e. in your chest and stuff like that, absolutely not,
because
you're not going to get anywhere. You're just going to make yourself worse.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that's how I'd look at that, really. And just remembering that when you are ill, if you're like properly ill as well, don't think, oh, you know, I can just come straight back and beast it. I've had a week off. Your body hasn't had a week off.
No.
A week of your immune system going at 100 miles an hour trying to fight off a virus or an infection is not a week off. That's absolutely exhausting for your body.
Yeah.
And you need to ease back in as well,
yeah,
in terms of how intense and frequent your training is. And then the other thing I always like to reassure people about is something we have chatted about, I think, before, about, you know, how long it takes to actually really lose meaningful amounts of fitness.
Yeah, yeah.
It's called the residual effects of training, where it's really well studied and, you know, researched, and it varies from person to person. But for instance, your aerobic fitness that, you know, takes so long to build also sticks around quite a lot. And untrained, your aerobic fitness shouldn't really change. It will only deteriorate at around 25 days plus or minus 5 days. Mm-hmm. So for some people that might be 20 days, other people might be 30. So that's quite a long time, you know.
Yeah.
Maximal strength is around that as well.
Yeah.
Power is a lot quicker. It's like 5 days.
Yeah.
But then it's also quicker to rebuild, you know, so it's all proportional. And so you're worried that you're losing everything, but probably you're not.
Yeah, I had a big block of time off and I was pretty surprised at how much strength I retained.
Yeah.
I was pretty close on from a weight perspective as to what I could move prior to injury and other things. So
it's funny. It's funny how it works, isn't it?
It's pretty mad. Yeah. Okay. And then with injury, I guess we're back to that sort of discomfort versus pain thing. If it's hurting, probably not good for you. But if you can move and you can keep active and you can do stuff and it's not causing any real pain, then,
then
why wouldn't you, I suppose?
Yeah. And it's just about just modifying what you do.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've got a knee injury, well, let's do some more upper body work.
Yeah.
You know, let's take the opportunities that we've got to close some other gaps, basically. And it's also getting on top of stuff early, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that person who, you know, every time you ride with them, they're like, oh, God, this knee. And you're like, and you say, have you actually been had a diagnosis? What's actually wrong with this knee? Oh, well, I looked on YouTube and it said I've got a meniscus, whatever. I'm like, well, no. Have you got, like, what's actually wrong with your knee?
Yeah.
Go and get a diagnosis and a plan for it and do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Because it's probably not just going to get better. Unless you're 18, then it probably will just fix itself, you know. But get on that stuff early.
Yep.
Because that stuff then, if it just escalates, it just sucks for your quality of life.
Yeah.
And then before you know it, you're missing rides or missing races and, you know, all that hard work's been for nothing.
Got it. All right, good stuff. Alistair then asked about structured training for kids who race, when to start them and what it should involve as they grow.
Cool. So this is, it's a big one, I think.
Yeah,
and it's something I'm seeing more and more of. I've got more young hitters on my programs and I'm working with them ever before, probably.
Nice.
And just to, it's kind of tricky in a way because, parents and kids all got different ideas and, you know, some are more intense than others and stuff like that. So my general experience, having worked with a lot of young athletes over the years, and including, you know what, I'm going to plug myself here, is that, you know, your current world champion, Charlie Hatton, I worked with him from the age of 14 or 15 all the way through until his first few years as a pro, maybe 2 years as a pro, his first senior World Cups, joining Trek Factory Racing with the Athertons and going through all of that. Now, obviously, he works for Alan Milway, top boy in the game, and he's doing an amazing job. But I have been through this and seen that level of success with an amazingly talented young rider, obviously. So the first thing I'd say is, does your child want to train? If they're showing an interest, they want to train because they've seen other kids training or seen pros training, then cool.
Yeah.
Let's get them doing something. If they're showing no interest in it, then let's not. Let's just, you know, except for, you know, I'd suggest that every human would benefit from some sort of strength training in their life, and they probably don't do much PE at school, you know, but, you know, maybe they can do some like press ups and, you know, bits and bobs, or maybe they're doing active stuff anyway. Maybe they're already digging at the trails and, you know, riding loads. Or
is this from a certain age though? Like, I've always been, and this might be totally wrong, but I was always led to believe that when kids are growing, there's certain things you shouldn't do from a physical perspective.
I think that's all basically been disproven these days. And so they can basically do whatever they want to. They're like incredibly robust. This idea that if you start strength training too young, it like stunts the growth plates because their muscles are too strong and stuff like that. As I understand it, that's all been pretty much disproven. So, you know, as for when, I mean, the general rule I would say is that this idea of very early specialization in sport is wrong. And the research in terms of which athletes turn out successful across a wide range of sports are not the ones who specialised early. So people like Tiger Woods, he's an outlier where he literally was given a golf club when he was two, and that's all he's ever done. Early specialisation usually leads to burnout and also limited physical skills as well, because you've only done one thing. And the best athletes are normally, across any sport, are normally the ones who do a wide range of sports growing up and right into their like teenage years. So they might play team sports like football or hockey or rugby. They might go swimming, they might do gymnastics or dancing or parkour, as well as like, or BMX and mountain bike or motocross or whatever you can think of, that developing that physicality, that ability to move, the coordination, those skills are what are going to best prepare any young kid to be good at any sport, basically. You know, rather than saying, oh, you know what, from the age of six, he's only riding bikes. We're going to tell school he can't play football after school in case he scrapes his knee or whatever. That's total nonsense. And that early specialization just, isn't going to work out well for anyone. Apart from anything, I think a lot of kids just end up quitting. Because it's too
gotta be fun, right?
Too one-dimensional.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing as well, is that they've got to want to do it. And then I always say when I start working with parents, like, you know, we need to try and make this enjoyable as much as possible. And they're not always going to want to do it if they've got GCSEs, exams going on and stuff. There's a lot going on. Like, you know, this is fine. We can back this off, you know, because actually, you know, for the sort of more competitive parents out there, no one really gives a shit if your 14-year-old kid wins a race or not. You know, it might help, you know, you might get a little bit more help next year, you know, to afford stuff or whatever. But in terms of really making it, it's not until their late teens that it really seems to matter, from what I can tell, apart from the odd prodigy who comes through, Jackson and stuff like that. So I guess in terms of training, you know, where we want to start is those fundamentals, those basics. You know, let's just get them squatting well. Let's get them do some single leg work, some balance work. Let's get them just moving around, doing like those crawls and hanging, doing the monkey bars, you know, the stuff that they kind of want to do anyway, naturally. That's just going to get them moving in all different directions. And, you know, whilst kind of almost building strength as a side effect in a way. As well as, you know, picking up some moderately heavy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I think that generally trying to, you know, rather than doing maybe 20 reps, you know, really high rep stuff, generally, you know, especially as kids are growing and developing their coordination, really high rep stuff just gives you lots of opportunity to like mess up the reps.
Okay.
You know, you start doing some good ones and you get tired or distracted. And then, you know, so generally maybe fewer reps but more sets
okay.
can be a good approach
yeah.
for youngsters to like learn to do things properly. And, you know, you get a similar training effect out the other end of it.
Yeah.
And social as well. You know, more and more schools do seem to have gyms and stuff, you know. And it's like, yeah, you know, if your kid's into mountain biking, but the rugby team or the football team are in the gym, you know, can you train with them, you know, for that group environment? That,
yeah.
And then it, then the gym's a positive, social, fun place that they're more likely to enjoy as they go forward, you know?
Yeah.
I've also got a number of, as far as I know, just father, son, there's probably some other ones as well, like using my online programs and where it's like, where it's like, this is how, part of how I spend time now with my lad or my, nice. You know, but it can be daughter or mum, it yeah. can be anything, but that's just what I've had yeah. emails about.
Oh, nice. So and, they're just doing it together.
Yeah, they're just in the garage and, yeah. you know, just having a chat, doing some press-ups, doing some pull-ups, lifting some weight, clinking, nice. You know, and stuff like that. And that's something that, you know, I'm trying to do as a father is, you know, in the school holidays, I bring my daughter, Daisy, I bring her to the gym.
Yeah.
And she watches, she'll sit and do some colouring and watch me coach for an hour. Because we got like a balcony mezzanine there, and then she'll come down and we'll do a little workout together. She's six,
yeah,
and she can pick up like the 4 kilo kettlebell,
yeah,
and then she swings on the TRX straps or or the gymnastic rings. She jumps off the plyo boxes, and you know, it's not training, it's not a workout, but it's just understanding that this is an environment where I can have fun and be active and be fit and strong.
It's a bit like going to the park, right?
Yes, same exactly.
Thing. They're clambering on stuff, jumping off things,
exactly.
pulling themselves up. Like,
yeah.
It's just a different environment for them to play in, but
yeah, totally.
There's benefits to be had.
So I don't know if I've kind of wandered from the main question there. I mean, in my mind, there is no too young to... Yeah. be active and to do lots of physical things.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, when you start off, you know, when you start to call it training, I would do my best to get some form of coaching or guidance or structure early on. Because we've all been there and I've seen loads of people who come to me with like bad habits, you know, where they've, you know, thought they've been squatting right all these years and doing press-ups right, and they really haven't.
Okay.
And you've got to unlearn it, you know?
Yeah. So you've got an opportunity with kids to get in from the start.
Yeah, yeah. You've got this blank canvas where let's just get it right at the start,
yeah.
you know? Like so many kids have skills coaching on the bike now as well, and they're obviously so good, you know, because right from the start they've been taught how to do it properly and they've got bikes that fit them and great places to ride. Well, let's do that off the bike as well.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah,
nice, like it, good stuff. All right, we've got a few questions around supplementation. First one from Rosh on email: thoughts on CBD for performance and recovery? It's a rapidly developing field, I guess.
Well, I don't know. I think it's regressing, actually.
Yeah.
I think,
okay.
Yeah, I think that. So, my initial reaction when I read this was, CBD just a fad, basically, just another thing for social media influencers to push to try and all this sort of nonsense. Because really, a few years ago, probably pre-COVID, CBD was like this new thing. It was massive, and you couldn't turn on your phone, your social media, without someone trying to tell you you should be taking it.
Yeah.
Fast forward, that's the first time I've heard CBD mentioned in a couple of years.
Okay.
Maybe we get different feeds, but as far as I'm concerned, everyone's like, it was a flash in the pan. A load of people bought it. Mm. Most people probably felt minimal to no effects.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to actually get and to really establish what is a quality product.
Yeah.
It's so unregulated.
Because
they all tell you they're pure. They all tell you they're this and they're that. And then, so it's very hard.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was like, no, Ben, Let's do some reading. And so there is, you know, there are some research papers out there that suggest that it can have positive effects for some people in terms of like mental health and depression and sleep and relaxation, as well as possibly, you know, like reducing muscle soreness and things like that. You know, if you literally rub it into your legs, for instance, and things like that. My caveat would be that obviously, for those who don't know, CBD is like an extract of cannabis. It's cannabis oil that in theory doesn't contain the THC, which is like the active bit that people like basically when they smoke a spliff. So as part of that process of making it, it is, and I read this on like the like anti-doping website basically, is that because CBD is not banned, but it is near impossible to guarantee that the product you're getting is completely free of THC, the active ingredient. And with it being the Wild West of supplements, and so the supplement game is like the Wild West.
Yeah.
There's a lot of bad actors and cowboys and unscrupulous people. Like you kind of don't know what you're going to get. And so if you are have any aspirations to be a pro athlete, or as any chance, or if you're going to get tested at a race, which is very few people listening, then do not touch CBD. I would tell all my athletes to never go near it because you might pop a drug test and ruin your reputation and your career. Yeah.
Some people get tested for work as well, I guess.
Or maybe you're like a driver for work and you have drug tests, then I'd stay clear of it there as well because you might pop a test. So that's the first one. And then the second one is, maybe for some people, you know, there's always, there's the curve, isn't there?
Yeah.
Most people, there might be this very small little effect. And for some people, no, basically no effect.
Yeah.
You know, they're to the left of the curve. And then there'll be a few like real responders who, to the right of the curve, who are like, this is amazing, it's a game changer. And they're always going to use those products. But for most people, I'm like, I'm just not sure what we're looking for. I mean, maybe look, if I was just coaching a normal rider at the gym, you know, a dad, a mum like us, whoever, who asking me about it, I'd say, okay, are you getting like 9 hours, you know, 8-9 hours of good quality sleep every night? Are you hitting your protein? Are you managing your stress? Are you doing all of these things? Are you drinking your water? Are you eating your fruits and veggies? Tick, 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 tick. Are you doing all of these things? Because they are the things that will make the biggest difference. If you're trying to make up for a crap diet and lack of sleep by rubbing some little drops on your arm or putting them under your tongue, then you are kidding yourself and you're wasting your money.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I would say about that.
I like it. All right. Still on supplements. Brad wanted to know what supplements you would recommend.
Cool. So the first one I would say, is a protein powder.
Yeah.
Now, in a way, you could call it a supplement. In a way, it's just convenient food, depending on how you look at it. Some people really be like, see it as this supplement and this like magic thing. And some people are a bit scared of it. Like, oh, I've heard if I don't do enough press-ups, it'll turn to fat and things like that. And it's like, no. Just think of protein powder as a convenient source of food and protein.
Yeah.
As we've already discussed, people struggle to get enough in.
Yeah.
And so make it easier. Get an extra 20 to 30 grams in a protein powder.
Okay.
And then the second one I would say is creatine. And you're on the creatine program.
Yeah.
I've been taking it for years. I take it about 9 months a year just so I get fed up of taking it.
Same. I tend to periodize it. And I think there's some science around the benefits of periodization with it a little bit as well.
Maybe. And I think, you know, so what is creatine and, you know, why might people want to think about taking it? Well, it's a naturally occurring in meat in particular. I think lamb is like the highest meat. And then I think it's in some seafood and stuff like that. And basically it helps you to produce more energy, to be stronger, more powerful. And there's also a lot of emerging science now about its potential protective effects in terms of concussion.
Yeah.
and treatment and recovery from concussion,
yeah.
As well as all sorts of stuff coming out now to do with like mental health and depression and all
cognitive
sorts.
Cognitive benefits, and, all sorts. Yeah.
And when I, again, you know, I was pretty happy that I was pretty squared away in my creatine knowledge, but I prepared for this. And just look around YouTube and there's, you know, always these things with a pinch of salt. There's an American doctor in a lab coat, you know, with a stethoscope around his neck telling you to take his brand of creatine. But it just seems to be an absolute avalanche of information out there at the moment about potential benefits.
Yeah.
And, you know, our perimenopausal single track woman, she should probably be on the creatine.
Yeah.
I've got my wife on it now and she was pretty resistant. She's like, am I gonna get massive?
Well, yeah, a lot of people see it as a bodybuilder thing, I think.
Exactly.
Don't they?
That's where, that's where it came from.
Historical thing,
yeah. But it's very cheap, very affordable.
It was very cheap. It's gone up a bit, but
yeah, I think with the popularity, but there's so much on the market. And I think with that as well, you don't need, there's like all these mad claims on like extra blends and they try and make it more complicated. You just need the cheapest, simplest creatine monohydrate.
Yeah.
You don't need any other versions that are more expensive or anything. So creatine monohydrate is what you need. And so, yeah, for me, it helps me to, I guess, look and feel good.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you know, when I train, I feel it's just a bit more effective. I can put on a little bit more muscle and I could be a bit more powerful. And it just helps for me. It's like a really low cost thing that just helps me to sort of do the things I want to do, to recover well from it and to sort of feel good basically. There are, you know, sometimes when people first start on it, if they do a loading phase at the start where you take a very high dose at the start, some people will get digestive issues. Yeah. You might get some diarrhea and things like that. I've never experienced that in a loading phase. And in fact, none of my athletes who've done a loading phase have ever had that either. Doesn't mean to say that you won't.
Yeah.
But if you are getting that, then just start slower.
Yeah, you don't need that. You don't need to load quickly.
Exactly.
Unless you've got a big event coming up or something that you want it in your system for, I guess. But otherwise, you can just dose at a regular daily rather than upping for that sort of two-week block.
Exactly. Yeah. And so like the loading phase, you know, would typically be in the region of 20 grams of creatine a day, split into 4 or 5 gram doses. And what that does is just speed things up. It means that you're going to get the benefits soon.
Yeah.
You get them in a week to 10 days rather than just starting. You know, I basically just take, for the last 20 years, probably I've had about 5 grams a day, you know. And, you know, then you're not going to have any issues that I know of. And it's like super safe and just, you know, so many supplements and make so many claims, but creatine is one that consistently comes out. Now, the only, I guess, thing to think about for some riders, maybe if you're more cross-country focused and, you know, climbing on watts per kilo, is the weight gain that will almost inevitably come from creatine because, you know, you retain a bit more water in your muscles maybe get a bit bigger and things like that. Is that you just need to do an experiment. So, and because it may be that your watts go up enough to outweigh that.
Yeah.
So creatine might be right for you, or you might use creatine for your training in the winter to make more progress, to train more intensity, and then you cycle off of it to race and that's how you feel better.
Yeah.
But that is, I would say, more like higher level competitive athlete stuff. That they would then need to manage. For most people listening, I'd say creatine would be a positive thing.
Yeah. Anything else you'd add onto that list? That seems to be...
Not really.
Yeah.
No.
Otherwise, just, it's more specific to like you have a gap or an issue personally and you might want to take this.
Yeah,
but for
yeah.
everyone, protein, some sort of protein source that's easy if you struggle to get enough, and creatine.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I mean, if we call it a supplement, maybe a multivit.
Yeah, okay.
It, again, that's a divisive one because there are a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, you know, it's just a load of stuff you don't need and then not enough of what you do need, you know, or, oh, it's just expensive. It just makes your, like, piss more expensive because you just, like, wheel out the stuff you don't need. And to me, you know, I think I eat a really balanced, well-rounded diet with loads of fruits and veggies and all that good stuff. But to me, it's like a few pence a day just to... you know, it's that little insurance policy.
Yeah, safeguard.
And if most of it whatever gets weed out, or, you know, for vitamin A, B, C, D, E or whatever, I've already got enough of that in my diet, but there's some mineral in there that I'm a little deficient in, niacin, who knows, iodine or whatever, yeah, you know, and it's in there and that just bumps me up, then that's all right. I think that's worth a few p a day.
Yeah,
just that little nutritional insurance policy.
Yeah,
is
yeah,
the way I see it.
But you don't feel the need to go to any like crazy expensive, some of these greens powders and stuff?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not really convinced, I'm okay, afraid, with the whole greens thing.
No, that's fair.
I guess, sorry, when I read the question actually and then sort of thought about my answer earlier, I didn't really think so much down the mainstream nutrition. I thought more like creatine and stuff, yeah, like that, because, again, not a doctor, but actually thinking more on the general health and nutrition side, in particular in Northern Hemisphere, like winter, is vitamin D.
Yeah.
Yeah, massive.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if you're in the Northern Hemisphere now, you know, it's March, it's March wherever you are actually, but you know, then there's a good chance, unless you've been taking, you know, you eat a lot of oily fish or have been away from some sun, that you're going to be vitamin D deficient.
Yeah.
And that is a big drama, more for some people than others.
Yeah.
But a vitamin D supplement, you know, maybe for some people, just what's in a multivit might be fine. Mm-hmm. For other people, a more specific supplement might be worthwhile.
Yeah.
And then, you know, through, you know, as we move into the spring, you'll be able to get the vitamin D from the sun, mm-hmm, assuming that you're not on the full, as endorsed by our government, you've got to be scared of the sun, you can't go out or you'll instantly get cancer, blah, blah, which I think is bollocks. Like, we need to be out in the sun.
Yeah, to some
not
extent.
Burning,
yeah,
not
yeah,
burning, obviously. But, you know, get out in the sun because that's the most natural way to get our vitamin D.
Yeah.
And so on. And a good guideline for when you can get vitamin D, and again, a guideline, is that when your shadow is shorter than your height, the sun will be generally be strong enough that you can get some vitamin D from it.
Okay.
So that's in terms of the time of day and obviously the time of year. And when your shadow is longer than your height, it probably means the sun's not going to be strong enough to get vitamin. And that's like, you know.
Yeah, rough guide.
Yeah, 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 yeah. But it's just a little
not
one
science
to think about.
Necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Nice. Never heard that one before. Okay. Jim says he's getting into intermittent fasting and plunge pooling, so cold exposure, I guess, and wants to hear your thoughts on those two.
Cool. Well, this is our friend, Jim Buchanan from Pin TV. And Jim's a really great guy and I've been following him for a while. And by the look of it, he's made a lot of real progress in his sort of health and fitness and lost some weight. And I've seen, before I knew about this question, on his Instagram that this has been part of it for him, this sort of like ice bath and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Which is, again, kind of like CBD, I think, is kind of like the ads I'm getting fed have all sort of been waning somewhat.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly through lockdown, this is a thing. You couldn't turn on your phone or your YouTube without getting an ad for, you know, an ice bath company, inflatable one or whatever. And it was very much like the thing for the last couple of years, and I think is subsiding a bit. And I'll say a similar thing to the whole CBD thing, where there's undoubtedly, I think, some health benefits physiologically, you know, in terms of, you know, what it can do to your body, that I think are potentially good things.
Yeah.
You know, and it's probably quite a natural thing for a human to go in cold water. You know, it's what we probably always did.
Yeah.
And also, you know, mentally, that enduring, that I'm going to do something I don't want to do.
Yeah.
It's going to suck, but I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to get through this little stress today and tomorrow and the next day, that's then going to help me to deal with all the other stresses in my life. And I think that is just as, if not more, valuable for people. What I will say is that it's very easy to get swept up in all of this stuff. And if I'm a bit pragmatic and a little pessimistic, I'm like, there's just going to be a lot of people out there who aren't just doing the basics. Like I said earlier with the CBD answer, they're not sleeping, they're not eating well, they're not exercising. And they think that because all these successful people are in their bloody plunge pools, you know, that this is going to suddenly fix their life and their issues. And they're going to do their Andrew Huberman morning routine and all this nonsense.
I was wondering how long it'd be before we mentioned
it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or whoever, you know, Rogan or whatever.
Yeah.
And that this is just going to fix their life. And I'm like, look, you know, maybe it will. I don't know. But to me, everyone I know, not everyone, most people I know who actually went down this route and bought them, none of them are still using them. But again, let's look at that curve. Jim is obviously to the right of that curve, where for him, the benefits have outweighed the hassle and the expense and all that sort of thing. And it's become a part of his lifestyle that has been really positive for him. So what I think in terms of Jim is brilliant, mate. Keep on doing it. Absolutely own it. Keep putting it on Instagram. I love it. And like just people doing hard stuff. It's cool. And if you feel great doing it, then do it. But to anyone else who's never tried it, who's always like, oh, I really think I should be doing this. I'm like, well, if you want to, then do. But if you don't, then don't. You know, just start by consistently having a cold shower every day for 2 months.
Yeah.
And then spend 500 quid on one of these bloody things.
Yeah.
You know, plungeables or just a wheelie bin full of ice and water, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I guess hopefully not negative, but just let's just weigh this up here.
Yeah, in context, you know, with the rest of your lifestyle, yeah,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. And do you really have the time and the scope to commit to prioritizing that over other things?
Yeah.
And then the other part of that is fasting. And again, it's one of those things where the people online who their whole YouTube channel, their whole identity and their brand is all about fasting, will tell you about all these magical properties about fasting, about, yeah, you know, and you'll be in this fat burning or, you know, and they'll tell you all these magical things. Yeah, you're going to lose fat because of your hormones and you're going to feel amazing and all this mental clarity and all this sort of stuff. And actually, you know, it's just you know, there's different ways of fasting, of course, but it's, again, maybe I'm being cynical, but it's just a different way of approaching the food you eat in a day. Mm-hmm. And if you do lose body fat, which is a positive thing for most people, as a result of this, it's because you've ended up in a calorie deficit consistently over time. And you've done that because you're eating for a few hours in the day, probably, or fewer days in the week if you're doing like two days fast. You know, there's different ways. So it's not through any like magical, you know, magical properties of fasting and things like that. And so for some people, this whole maybe time-restricted eating, which is a form of fasting, where maybe you only eat between midday and 7 or 8 at night, so you fasted for 16 hours.
Yeah.
You know what? For a really busy person juggling a lot of stuff in the morning, then actually skipping breakfast, which is another word for it, might work really well for them. And then they can have a lunch and a dinner and some, you know, and it just works and that's cool. But if, like me, you know, and I have fasted in the past, I've been down this rabbit hole a bit. Actually, I generally feel better just having breakfast every day and my life works where I can make a good breakfast, then do that. You know, it's not, it's one of those really.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, you can try it. The other thing I would say as well is that fasting and like that calorie restriction for men is generally safe, in inverted commas. Like, you know, you might be hungry. It might work for you. It might not work for you. But it's probably not going to like mess around with you too much.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of women do get issues with fasting, you know, and extended periods of like calorie restriction and things like that, in terms of just energy and menstrual cycle, potential side effects and things like that.
Okay.
Where I would proceed with caution.
Yep. Fair. All right. Sean is doing a bit of downhill racing. He wants to know what he should focus on from now to July, because he's feeling like he can't hold on and push for the second half of the track. He said it's not through arm pump, but he's feeling like he's out of gas. He wasn't making good decisions. So obviously sort of cognitively he's struggling, and his rear leg specifically was burning with lactate. What sort of stuff should he be working on over the next few months?
Cool. And that's the great thing, isn't it? Is he's given us all the
specifics.
Questions. Yeah. All the questions I was going to then ask, it's like, and he's narrowed it down. So Sean's already identified the gaps,
yeah,
which is what anyone should do. Like, if anyone's thinking, I'm struggling with the second half of a race, identify the gaps to fill. So I would look at this, I guess it's a conditioning issue, mm-hmm. to me, primarily. I mean, there may be some strength and stuff, but I would look at getting some sort of intervals or something like that going that are a similar duration to the race.
Yeah.
And especially as he's doing downhill rather than enduro, I wouldn't just be tied to intervals on the bike or turbo trainer.
Yeah.
Maybe use the rower, assault bike,
okay.
skier,
yeah.
things like that as well, or instead. And so what we're looking for there is that, you know, let's do some longer, well, let's do intervals anywhere from 1 to 3 minutes is what I would think of doing, of high intensity work followed by a period of recovery, mm-hmm. you know. And for certainly for a 3 minute interval, there's no point doing 3 minutes on, one off. Yeah, that's nothing like a race.
Yeah.
And then you do two of those and you're done, because then you can't go for 3 minutes. So, you know, do three on, three off or something like that.
Yeah.
To then recover, to then repeat the effort. Because what we want to do is we want to develop your cardiovascular system, but also your muscles' ability to deal with all that big buildup mm-hmm. of lactate. And to develop that capability, we need to do it to a high quality reps, basically.
Yeah.
And when we cut down the rest too soon or too much, the quality dips off too much.
Your power drops off.
Yeah, exactly. We want to be hitting those good power numbers, those good consistent efforts. So if you do 5 reps of 3 on 3 off, which is a lot, actually, you might want to start with 3 or 4 reps.
Yeah.
You know, they should all be a similar level of intensity, and if not, ramping up for the last one.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather start a bit moderate and see how you are on the day mm-hmm. and then build them, rather than starting too hard, which is men, let's face it. That's how they go. They're like, and then it plummets off. Like, you can almost plot two graphs of, you can set the same interval session to a man and a woman, and the woman would normally just pace it quite well.
Nail the brief.
They're just a bit smarter than us, aren't they? And probably get a really good session, whereas the men, their lines would just cross in the middle, uh-huh. and I know whose session would be better. But and similarly, you know, on the rower, let's say, 1,000 meter row, disgusting, you know. Do a good warm up. Mm-hmm. Make sure your rowing technique stands up to hard effort as well.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people I see, and they can row nicely, like a 5 out of 10. But then you say, right, let's work hard now for a couple of minutes, and their technique's disgusting.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're all open, and they fall off the seat, and bang their bum on the rail and stuff. So assuming your technique can stand up to hard rowing, then 1,000 meter best effort, that'd be a good one.
Yeah.
Do that. Record that at the start. That's your starting point. And then, you know, once or twice a week, do a couple of 1,000 meter best efforts with a good recovery in between. And, you know, start nudging that down. Mm-hmm. You know, it might be, you know, over 4 minutes to start with, and then 4 minutes, then 3:50, you know, and you want to be getting that down. That's going to prepare you well, because that's your whole body as well. And it's quite a specific duration mm-hmm. and intensity that would tie in well with downhill racing.
Okay. What about the old sort of sprint into the top of your shorter track when you're out on your trail ride, like that whole learning to process and still make good decisions when you're hanging is...
Yeah, there's definitely that. So there's the more, the real world, race simulation stuff, if you like. And then the other thing to do as well is, if maybe your local trails are short, then like I said earlier, you need to go somewhere and ride longer tracks, get to the bike park, get to the bigger hills, get to the mountains to help you become accustomed to doing longer runs. And if you can do runs that are even practice runs that are 5 minutes and you only race 3, then that's only a good thing. Then you can exceed the demands of the event. And like you say, if your local hill is a minute, then, you know, maybe you could do 20-second sprint into the top of the trail. You ride the minute down, then when you get to the bottom, do a 30-second effort at the bottom of the hill or something like that. To get the maximum bang for your buck.
All right, good stuff. Here's a good one for you. E-bikes, help or hinder fitness, discuss.
So there's been quite a bit of this chat recently, actually.
Yeah, there is.
It depends.
I think it's both, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So good example. Today is like really muddy, really wet. We really steep hills here. We probably wouldn't have ridden if we hadn't been on e-bikes today. It would have been an absolute slog.
Yeah.
And we would have got one drop in the time and we still would have had the same amount of work and tidy up and washing to do afterwards. So in terms of that, I mean, for me, my e-bike in the winter in particular makes me ride more. Mm-hmm. If I ride more, I'm probably going to be fitter and a better rider. It gives you flexibility. So again, especially, you know, for like my pro guys who get to ride a lot and they train hard, the e-bike means they can go mountain biking but get up the hill with minimal effort to get maximum reps in, maximum descending reps, and they can stay aerobic on the way up. And then we can control things that bit more.
Yeah.
Where it's can certainly be detrimental is if you go just e-bike only and you never pedal anymore and you don't do any strength training, then you're going to get less fit.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty obvious.
Especially if you, you're a boost mode all day kind of.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and it's really easy to do that. I mean, like mine's pretty much always in boost mode. Like that's how I ride it. The batteries are bigger. You can go a lot further in boost mode, can't you? So yeah, it can help or hinder. It's a tool, you know, without taking the fun side out of it. I think that it's a tool and you can use it however you want. And for me, it's a tool for fun and skill acquisition. Because if I ride on my own on a weekday, like I talked about earlier, then I can do laps of one track. Rather than just doing a big loop, I can go and do like one track on my local hill and I can do eight to 10 laps of it in an hour. And if you want to get better and develop your skills, then sessioning, I think we all know, is really effective. And my e-bike helps me to session trails to become a better, more skilled rider, which is something I love doing.
There you go. Solid answer. All right, we'll wrap up with a good question from Amen. It's a nice, simple one. What's the secret recipe to winning a race, downhill or enduro?
The secret recipe. Happy days. The secret recipe. I guess we're all trying to find that, aren't we? But you know, you got to boil it down to the components, aren't they? Because everyone's recipe is going to be a bit different.
Yeah.
You know. So, are you fit and strong enough to ride at a race winning intensity from the top to bottom, from the start to the finish?
Yeah.
Do you have the skills, literally, to do that? You know, do you have a routine, race day routine and rituals that mean you are in the correct mental and emotional state to apply that fitness and execute your skills to the highest degree?
Yeah.
Then I guess the next one is, do you really want it? Do you really want it that much? You know, that you really want to win? Because the best in the world, Loic Bruni, he really, really, really wants to win every race he does.
Yeah.
You know, and most of us aren't like that, you know. Don't get me wrong, I'd love to win a race. But maybe my mindset's different because I'm not at that level, you know, where I'm threatening to win races. Uh-huh. But still, you know, do you really have that motivation? So that's kind of the big picture stuff that's kind of not answering anything. But then the way I talk to riders about it, so sometimes I do work with riders like on the hill and we talk about their race routine and their mindset, maybe some breathing, some visualization and all that sort of stuff. That, and then, because it's a big goal winning a race, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is first one, is control the controllables, because you don't know what anyone else is going to do. So you're not racing the other racers, you're racing the track.
Yeah.
You're racing the clock, that cliche.
Yeah.
But it's true. So don't worry about anyone else or what they're doing. It doesn't matter. It's about you doing your best run. And then, like a big goal, we break it down. So the winning time, let's call it a downhill race, is the quickest average speed from the top to the bottom. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, from the start gate to the first corner, who you know, maybe that's not winning the race, but you know, we need to be above a certain speed there with like effort on the pedals and your available power. And then you win a race, like one corner at a time. And so it's knowing the track, setting up, executing, carrying exit speed. It's just executing the basics, because that's what it is. It's just the basics, isn't it? It's body position, it's braking, it's looking where you're going.
Yeah.
It's posture, carrying speed, and then executing that run where every corner you exit with a fraction of a kilometer an hour more than the person in second, because that's all it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you win? I guess that's how.
Yeah.
One corner at a time is how you win.
And it's detail, I guess, right? Everything is, you've ticked all the boxes. Mm-hmm. You've looked after yourself. You've slept well. You've fed well. You've trained well.
Yeah.
Your power's where you think it needs to be.
Yeah.
Your head's where it needs to be. Your support network around you is what you want and what you need. Like, it's all of those things.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And just going into it with the right mindset for you, you know, and something I talked to like racers of all different levels, like, you know, some racers need like picking up, like G'ing up, like firing up for the race. You almost want to like slap them across the face, because like that's the racer who the first sector is always a bit off, or they're an enduro racer and stage one, they're off the pace. They're like maybe not a morning person, or they struggle to get going. Their warm up needs to be more energetic. Their music, or they're listening to, or that some aggressive breathing and like, you know, physical movement, jumping on the spot and stuff. But give that warm up to the guy or girl who always blows out the first turn, because or always breaks a wheel, and you got nothing but dramas. That rider who's overstimulated, just like, got to get after it. No, you know, hyper. They need to get the Bob Marley on the iPod, you know, and breathe, visualize, calm, execute, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's figuring out who you are, what sort of rider you are. You know, like, is it? Yeah, I think like Greg Minnaar talks about understanding where he can push and where it needs to be easy.
Yeah.
You know, where on the track does your strengths, your riding style and the track all coincide that you can go at like 100% there and take more risk? Mm. And which parts of the track you need to like back it off in terms of the track and or your, you know.
It's a fascinating puzzle, and I think that's part of why that's like
the whole,
it, right?
That's the whole puzzle, isn't it? You know?
Love it.
Yeah.
Nice, man. Well, we've covered loads of stuff, loads of great information. Thank you. Apologies to anyone whose questions we haven't got to, but we are pretty much at the 2-hour mark, so we should probably wrap up.
Cool.
I think you've got some offers for listeners if anyone wants help on the strength and conditioning side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, if I didn't answer your question, or if anyone's got any questions, I always say I'm an open book, Chris. There's no secrets. I answer my emails, my DMs. If you've got any questions, I'd love to help you. And there's no obligation. You don't have to buy my programs like I'm about to tell you about. but if you do want a program, if you do want me to do the legwork for you and give you a program that is literally guaranteed to get you results or you get your money back, then yeah, head on over to the website where I've got a couple of different options for you. So for all those like rad dads and gnarly mums out there who are mountain biking, I've got my over 40s program, which takes a bit more of a gradual, steady approach to training that is really all about looking after your body and fitting into a busy lifestyle. Then we've got that over 40s mountain bike program. If you're a bit more like performance focused or a bit younger and you've got a bit of fitness already, then I've got the complete mountain bike program for trail enduro riders, and that's a subscription based program. Or for downhill races, I've got the downhill version of that as well.
Yeah.
Now for all of those programs, you can use the code DOWNTIME30. So all capital letters, no spaces, DOWNTIME30, and that will either give you 30% off the price of the over 40s program.
Yeah.
Or you'll get 30% off the first 2 months of the complete mountain bike program or complete DH program. And you still get a 1 week free trial to try it out before you pay anyway.
Sweet.
So I'd like to say it's a bit of a no brainer. And if there's one thing to sum things up is that it's not your bike that's holding you back, you know, or you can't just buy performance, you know. If you've got a good pair of tires and you've had your fork serviced and it's not a complete wreck, then it's not your bike that's holding your back. It's probably you and your body. So invest in yourself, invest in your health, be a better human, be a better rider. And if you've got any questions, drop me a line.
And the website is?
thestrengthfactory.uk.
Yeah.
And also, tell you what, while we're there, if you want lots of additional free training content, then you should definitely get over to my YouTube, where I'm fastly approaching 8,000 subscribers, followers, which I'm pretty excited about. There's loads of good stuff on there.
Nice.
And yeah, give that a follow. Cheers. Wicked.
Yeah, we'll stick links to all of that stuff in the show notes.
Chris.
How long does the offer run for?
That's running for nearly 3 weeks. So it runs out on Sunday, 21st of April.
Okay.
Probably UK time.
Yeah.
Just do it the day before anyway.
Nice.
Just to be sure.
All right. So yeah, we'll stick links to all of that in the show notes. We'll stick links to some of the other things we've mentioned as well. As always, thanks, mate. Loads of knowledge dropped on us, loads of useful stuff, and hopefully it helps listeners and viewers get fitter, stronger, better, and have more fun on bikes.
Nice. Let's get some lunch. Nice. Cheers. One.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
All right, that's it for this episode with Ben. I really hope you've enjoyed it and found it useful for your own fitness and riding. A massive thanks to Seven Mesh for supporting this episode of the show. They've just launched their Spring-Summer 2024 mountain bike range on sevenmesh.com that features heaps of awesome new colours as well as an updated version of their fan-favourite GlidePath pant, which aims to be your perfect trail riding pant. So if you're ready to elevate your riding experience, then head over to sevenmesh.com, that's the number 7 followed by the word mesh, and use the code DOWNTIMEX7MESH20 to enjoy 20% off. That's DOWNTIME, all lowercase, followed by the letter X, the number 7, MESH20. If you'd like to support the podcast, that could be via a regular donation at patreon.com/downtimepodcast, by grabbing yourself some merch from downtimepodcast.com/shop, or by sharing the episodes with your friends or online, or you could subscribe to my YouTube channel at youtube.com/@downtimepodcast and show the videos some love with likes and comments to help the channel grow. Stay connected by following the podcast. Hit that button in your podcast app now, or visit downtimepodcast.com/follow. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook too, where we're at Downtime Podcast. For that extra dose of downtime, sign up to our newsletter at downtimepodcast.com/newsletter. All right, that's it for today. We're going to have another awesome episode coming up really soon. But until next time, get out and ride.